This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Target Lebanon, The Untold Story. The Israeli invasion of Lebanon continues unabated. On August 19th, only 5 days after a supposed ceasefire brokered by the United Nations, Israeli commandos, helicopter-borne, invaded Budai, Lebanon. Budai, a village in the Bekaa Valley, 20 miles from the Syrian border and 10 miles west of the historic city of Baalbek. Sleiman Shames, 38 years old, the mayor of the village, gave the following account to the New York Times reporters Robert Wirth and John Kiffner. Israeli commandos disguised in Lebanese army uniforms landed in the eastern foothills of the Mount Lebanon range, loaded into Humvees that had been dropped by helicopters, and drove east on a road called Ayun Simam, where they encountered a roadblock guarded by the local Hezbollah fighters. They passed that roadblock and proceeded on to the next. The Israeli commando shouted in Arabic, "Peace be with you, we're one of yours." But their accent wasn't that of a Lebanese. They tried to pass the roadblock. They made it to the next, where the guerrillas started shooting and chased them. The commandos turned onto a dirt road where a gun battle broke out, and villagers descended upon the Israeli commandos. As Mayor Shamas said, the whole village came down, both those who had arms and could shoot and those who cannot. Israeli fighter jets and helicopters fired rockets and within 40 minutes had evacuated the commandos, he said. But they left behind two fresh craters targeting a bridge in the rich red Bekaa Valley soil as well as the bridge. There were signs of casualties. Those casualties were the Israeli commandos, large bloodstains, syringes, surgical masks, and what the villagers said was some kind of device to guide the helicopters. No casualties were reported on the Lebanese side. Yaha Ali, 30 years old, wearing a red shirt and carrying an AK-47 assault rifle, according to the New York Times reporters, was one of the number of villagers who said the Israeli commandos had been dressed like Lebanese soldiers. They were wearing the mostly green woodland camouflage uniforms that are standard issue for the Lebanese army, along with olive green flak jackets and green helmets, also standard issue. While Israeli soldiers wear normally a solid brownish uniform with brown body armor and helmets. Mr. Ali could see the uniforms clearly because in the rescue, the helicopters and the Humvees had bright lights turned on. Why Budai? Why this remote small village in the Bekaa Valley? Budai is the native home of Sheikh Mohammed Yazbek, a senior Hezbollah leader. He doesn't live there anymore, but there had been a funeral, and the Israelis thought he had returned to attend that funeral. Yazbek is a member of the Shura Council. The Israeli army did not capture him. They even denied that the capture was their objective, according to the Associated Press. Yet here we have, right after the ceasefire brokered by the United Nations and agreed upon by the Zionist forces, here we have them with a major commando assault on Lebanon. Ralph?
The language that is used by the bourgeois press whenever the Israelis undertake an invasion occupation is that they engage in an incursion or a raid. This is an invasion. And it's spelled out on August 20th in the New York Times in an article headlined, the author Stephen Erlinger, "Israel Committed to Block Arms and Kill Nasrallah." Despite a ceasefire, Israel intends to do its best to keep Iran and Syria from rearming Hezbollah. And the article spells out that what that means is a series of continued attacks, continued invasions, and the article continues, and their objective is to kill the leader, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, said a senior Israeli commander. The officer speaking on condition of anonymity in an interview on Friday, but speaking one day before the commandos carried out their raid, stated that Israel would continue to seek out and block any attempts of Hezbollah to operate, and he added the following. He made clear Sheikh Nasrallah remained a target and that there, quote, is only one solution for him. This man must die. This man must die, quote, unquote, the terror state. Supposing that Nasrallah and Hezbollah targeted Olmert, the prime minister of Israel, or Rafi Eitan, the intelligence chief who carries out all the slaughter, or the minister of defense, or the home minister, and said that they would be assassinated and this person would be killed, how would the media of the world respond to this open declaration of an assassination attempt with regard to the leaders of the Zionist state? It is an outlaw state. It is a state that knows no limitations, and it is measured by the fact that the United Nations passed at the Security Council 88 resolutions condemning Israel from 1967 to 1988. The Security Council passed 43 outright condemnations of Israeli provocations and operations during that period. The General Assembly, 429 United Nations resolutions condemning Israel, and 321 General Assembly resolutions specifically calling out Israel for violation of international law, for breach of boundaries, and for outright invasions. You are talking here about a total of nearly 900 United Nations resolutions, every single one of which has been ignored, violated, and the Zionist state operating with impunity. What does this all mean, brothers and sisters? We are dealing with a reckless, imperialist-sponsored outlaw state that brooks no limitation and respects no international purview.
And Ralph, this is clear to the Lebanese people, as I mentioned before, as the mayor said, and as his wife reiterated when she spoke to the Los Angeles Times reporters, quote, all, not only Hezbollah, fought. All the people in the village brought their guns to fight. 15-year-old boys brought guns. They failed completely, Sadiq Hamdi, a scrap iron dealer, told the New York Times. They were still on the road when Hezbollah came upon them. They did not take 1% of what they are trying to do. The villages, every single villager who spoke to the U.S. press, was proud to say that the Israeli attempts were a failure and that they were there to defend their village, their homeland. Let's look at some of the history, as Ralph was saying, speaking of the UN resolutions. But let's look at the words of the Zionists themselves. And we turned once again to the hidden history of Zionism by Ralph Schoenman. And in Chapter 7, The Myth of Security, because the Zionist state is always saying that its incursions into Lebanon, its attacks against Lebanon, its perception of a threat by Syria, by Iran, by Iraq, by Egypt, by any of the countries of the Middle East, are all on the basis of the attacks, the impending attacks on the Zionist state. As Chapter 7 notes, the myth of security. Security has been the catchphrase deployed to screen widespread massacre of civilian populations throughout Palestine and Lebanon for the confiscation of Palestinian and Arab land, for the expansion into surrounding territory, the establishment of new settlements, for deportation, and for sustained torture of political prisoners. Let's look at the words of the Zionists themselves, and let's look at the real intent, which, as we've said often, is the capture, the inclusion into the Zionist state of the nations of the Middle East. First, breaking them up into their components, into ethnic and religious components, and then incorporating them into the Zionist state. The publication of the personal diary of Moshe Sharet, who had been the Prime Minister of Israel from 1954 to 55, Director of the Jewish Agency's Political Department, and Foreign Minister of Israel from 1948 to 1956. The publication of his personal diary in 1979 reveals, and we are going to refer to the Sharet diaries, it reveals in explicit language that the Israeli political and military leadership never believed in any Arab danger to Israel. They sought to maneuver and force the Arab states into military confrontations, which the Zionist leadership were certain of winning, so Israel could carry out the destabilization of Arab regimes and the planned occupation of additional territory. The Sharet diaries document the long-standing program of the Israeli leaders from both Labor and Likud, quote, to dismember the Arab world, defeat the Arab national movement, create puppet regimes under regional Israeli power. And then Sharet cites cabinet meetings, position papers, policy memoranda, which prepared the wars, quote, to modify the balance of power in the region, radically transforming Israel into the major power in the Middle East. Ralph?
To bring about the liquidation of all Palestinian claims to Palestine through the dispersal of Palestinians to the distant corners of the world. The Sharet diaries document a long-standing program of all of Israel's leaders from both Labor and Likud, quote, to dismember the Arab world, destroy the Arab national movement, and create puppet regimes under regional Israeli power, unquote. In fact, the Sharet diary cites specific cabinet meetings, position papers, and policy memoranda preparing a series of wars to modify any balance of power in the region and radically transform Israel into the major power of the Middle East.
Well, Ralph, let's look at one of these meetings, position papers, and detailed plans. 1954. David Ben-Gurion, then Prime Minister, and Moshe Dayan developed a detailed plan to instigate internal Lebanese conflict in order to fragment Lebanon. And we're going to focus on the plans of the Zionist state with regard to Lebanon in this show. This was 16 years before an organized Palestinian political presence occurred in Lebanon. The Palestinians entered Lebanon after they were expelled from Jordan in 1970. That is when King Hussein slaughtered the Palestinians in what is known as Black September. Sharet described, quote, the use of terror and aggression to provoke, end quote, in order to facilitate conquest. And we continue with the quote from the Sharet diaries. I have been meditating on the long chain of false incidents and hostilities we have invented and on the many clashes we have provoked, which cost so much blood, and on the violations of law by all our men, all of which have brought grave disaster and determined the whole course of events. So again, in 54, the plans of David Ben-Gurion and Moshe Dayan formulated the war plan for the absorption of Lebanon. According to Sharet, according to Dayan, the only thing that's necessary is to find an officer, even a major. We should buy him to make him agree to declare himself the savior of the Maronite population. This is the Maronite Christian population. Then the Israeli army will enter Lebanon, will occupy the necessary territory, and will create a Christian regime which will ally itself with Israel. Note what follows. The territory from the Litani, that's the Litani River, southward will be totally annexed to Israel, and everything will be all right. If we were to accept the advice of the chief of staff, we would do it tomorrow, without awaiting a signal from Baghdad.
That is the Baghdad of Nuria Said and the infant King Faisal. Nuria Said, known as the stooge of Baghdad, a British intelligence agent, when Baghdad or the Iraq was within the Baghdad Pact and under the thumb of U.S. imperialism and of John Foster Dulles in its totality. 12 days later, Diane moved into high gear for the planned invasion, occupation, and dismemberment of Lebanon. Here again is Moshe Charette's extraordinary diary. The chief of staff supports a plan to hire a Lebanese officer who will serve as a puppet, so the Israeli army may appear as responding to his appeal to liberate Lebanon from Muslim oppressors. The entire scenario for the 1982 war, by the way, was in place 28 years earlier. In fact, Moshe Charette recounts how the invasion of Lebanon was postponed. Quote, the CIA gave Israel the green light to attack Egypt. The energies of Israel's security establishment became wholly absorbed by the preparations for the war, which unfolded exactly 1 year later. So, in every respect, the Charette diaries and the documents of the Zionist state itself make clear that the target of Lebanon, as with other Arab states, was on a timetable, had nothing to do with any internal developments within that country itself. Quote, we have a free hand, and God bless us if we act audaciously. The U.S. wants us to topple Nasser's regime, but does not dare at the moment to use the methods it used in toppling the leftist government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954 and of Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. It wants this work done by Israel, the diary continues. General Isser has seriously and pressingly insisted we carry out our plan for the occupation of Gaza now. The situation has changed, and there are other reasons which determine that it's time to act. First, there's a discovery of oil near Gaza, and we need to occupy and dominate that strip. And that's alone worthwhile, even with the troublesome question of the additional refugees. Then Moshe Charette, anticipating another wave of slaughter, which in fact occurred, wrote on February 17, 1955, quote, we cry out over our isolation and the dangers to our security, but it is we who initiated aggression and reveal ourselves as bloodthirsty and aspiring to perpetuate and perpetrate mass massacres, quote unquote. With respect to Gaza, this is instructive. Charette's own evaluation of March 27, 1955 would be prophetic. Quote, let us assume that there are 200,000 Arabs in the Gaza Strip. Let us assume that half of them will be made to run to the Hebron Hills. They will run away without anything. Shortly after they establish themselves in some stable environment, they will again become homeless. It is easy to imagine the outrage and hate and bitterness. We shall have 100,000 of them in the Strip. It's easy to imagine what it means when we will have to resort to suppress them. What kind of headlines we will receive in the international press. In the first round, Israel will aggressively invade the Gaza Strip. In the second, Israel will once again cause the terrified flight of masses of Palestinian refugees. Their hate will be rekindled by the atrocities that we shall continue to cause them to suffer during occupation. Unquote. 1 year later, Diane's troops occupied the Gaza Strip, Sinai, the Straits of Tehran, and were deployed along the Suez Canal with precisely the effects described and anticipated by Moshe Charette.
Doesn't this sound familiar? The plans that were exposed by Moshe Charette did not originate with David Ben-Gurion or Moshe Dayan. Let's look at the historical antecedents. In 1904, Theodore Herzl described the territory over which the Zionist movement laid claim as inclusive of all the land, quote, from the Brook of Egypt to the Euphrates. This territory embraces all of Lebanon and Jordan, two-thirds of Syria, one-half of Iraq, a strip of Turkey, one-half of Kuwait, one-third of Saudi Arabia, the Sinai, and Egypt, including Port Said, Alexandria, and Cairo. In his testimony before the United Nations Special Committee of Inquiry, July 9, 1947, which was preparing the partition of Palestine, Rabbi Fishman, the official representative of the Jewish Agency for Palestine, reiterated Herzl's claim, and this map is included in the Hidden History of Zionism. The Promised Land extends from the River of Egypt up to the Euphrates. It includes parts of Syria and Lebanon.
That's a direct quote from the testimony before the Special Committee of Inquiry on July 9, 1947, by Rabbi Fishman.
I would like to also note that Chaim Weizmann wrote David Lloyd George, Britain's prime minister in 1919. And he stated, quote, "The minimum requirements essential to the realization of the Jewish national home," end quote, that had been promised in the Balfour Declaration 2 years previously, include the boundaries cannot be drawn exclusively on historic biblical lines. Our claims to the north are imperatively demanded by the requirements of modern economic life. Now, what Chaim Weizmann exposes is the true nature of how the Zionists came upon these boundaries, Lebanon and the parts of Iraq, Jordan, parts of Egypt up to the Nile, and this is what he said. The whole economic future of Palestine is dependent upon its water supply for irrigation and for electric power. And the water supply must mainly be derived from the slopes of Mount Hermon, from the headwaters of the Jordan, and from the Litani River of Lebanon.
Maya, in 1918, Great Britain was informed officially by the World Zionist Movement of their claims to Lebanon up to and inclusive of the Litani River. British planned in 1920 to designate the Litani as the northern border of a Jewish state. This was only altered in response to French objections, which regarded Lebanon and Syria as their territory. By 1936, the Zionists offered to support Maronite, the Catholic minority in Lebanon. The Maronite patriarch testified to the Peel Commission in favor of a Zionist state in Palestine, and Ben-Gurion spoke of Zionist plans for Lebanon to be occupied and absorbed by Israel to the Zionist World Workers' Party then meeting in Zurich. Speaking of the Maronites as their instruments, they are the natural ally of the Land of Israel. The proximity of Lebanon will further our allies as soon as the Jewish state is created and give us the opportunity to expand. By 1948, Israel occupied up to the Litani. It withdrew a year later under pressure again from France. Charette reports of Ben-Gurion's timetable in 1954 to induce the Maronites to fragment Lebanon. Quote, "This is now the central task. We will invest the time and energy to bring about a fundamental change in Lebanon. Dollars will not be spared. We will not be forgiven if we miss this historic opportunity." Now, the invasion of Lebanon in 1982 followed a series of invasions in 1968, 1976, 1978, and 1981. The plans to dismember Lebanon were joined to the primary objective of dispersing the Palestinian inhabitants of Lebanon through massacre, followed by expulsion, the exact process through which Palestine had been emptied of its population in the first place, the exact methods through which Gaza was targeted and described in the diaries of Charette. Quote, "The invasion was planned jointly with the United States government. The Maronite Falange," the Falange being the fascist party that was modeled on Francisco Franco's Falange, "was part of the project." Quote, "When Amin Gemayel visited Washington the previous fall," this is prior to the invasion of 1982, "he was asked by an American official when the invasion was due. Later, when Ariel Sharon visited Washington, Secretary of State Alexander Haig gave the green light for the invasion." And we will address the invasion of 82 in due course.
Ralph, the major invasion of 68 was preceded October 26, 1965, into Lebanon, the first armed raid, which destroyed three water reservoirs in a Lebanese border town. The water pumps and pipelines were the target of the Israeli strikes into Jordan and Syria at that time, too. And let's look at why water is the real source of these invasions and why the Litani and the Israeli attempts to always occupy and move up to the Litani are so important.
Well, move up to and beyond.
And beyond. Israeli water experts are aware, writes the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, July 1991, in its magazine, that by 1979, all the water resources available within the Zionist states 1948 borders had been exploited. By the early 1980s, Israel was getting half of its water from Arab sources located outside the pre-1967 boundary, resources which were overexploited by more than 10%. 85% of the water in the large aquifer below the West Bank is used currently by Israeli settlers or pumped into Israel, while the Palestinian water consumption in the occupied territories is sharply curtailed. Average water use per capita among Palestinians is only 25 cubic meters per year, and this is below a level determined by the United Nations as necessary to maintain minimal health standards. Whereas the average Israeli rate is 170 cubic meters annually.
Well, to put this into its perspective, Maya, and we're going to deal with the original plans, because all of the Zionist machinations going back to before the First World War, and in its discussions with the British and with the South Africans with respect to the Balfour Declaration, they were all designed to encompass within a Zionist state the headwaters of the major rivers, and those are not only going to include the Litani and the Hasban, but the Yarmouk that's in Syria, and the Jordan River itself, and the headwaters of the Nile and the Euphrates. Here is the full-page advertisement placed by Israel's Ministry of Agriculture with respect to the West Bank. Quote, the ministry states that allowing any Palestinian water to escape Israeli control constitutes a mortal danger for Israel and would in a most tangible way endanger our continued existence. It is difficult to conceive of any resolution that is not consistent with Israel's survival, that does not involve complete Israeli control of all of the water, sewerage systems, associated infrastructure, including power supply, road networks, essential to operation, maintenance, and accessibility. 85% of the water in the entire aquifer below the West Bank has been allocated to Israeli settlers or pumped into Israel. Palestinian water consumption in the occupied territories was totally curtailed. The average water per capita amongst Palestinians was 25 cubic meters per year, where the Israeli rate was 170 cubic meters annually. Maya?
Yes, Ralph. Israel also takes 100 million cubic meters of water from the Yarmouk. Remember, the Yarmouk is in Syria. It originates in the Golan Heights, which was occupied by the Israelis, and they drove out 200,000 Syrians. Israel diverts all of the Jordan River above Lake Tiberias, leaving only a polluted trickle downstream. Many international water experts agree that Israel is either trucking water or installed underground pipelines to divert the Litani River while it occupied southern Lebanon.
Now, that's actually a statement from the study done by the Washington Report on Middle Eastern Affairs by Catherine Casa, which has the documentation for this.
And we should note that there has been ongoing negotiations between the Zionist state and the Lebanese government over this seizure of the waters of the Litani and also the destruction of wells in Lebanon.
When you speak of a Lebanese government, we have to be clear, Maya. We're talking about the Falange and Maronite and Christian Alliance regimes imposed by Washington that were selling out the water of the country to Israel. But even these water sources, Catherine Casa reports, were not enough. Israel's dealings with Ethiopia were designed, quote, to obtain access and control of the Nile. Of the Nile. In fact, the Zionists were planning to deflect the Blue Nile and to obtain its waters and channel them to the Israeli state. And this is gone into in considerable detail in this report. But the implications of a multi-billion-dollar price tag for Israel's water needs were not lost on Washington, because Washington was going to bear the cost. That is to say, the $100 billion that goes to the Zionist state includes the usurpation of all the water resources of the region, the deflection of the major rivers that flow in other countries, the emptying of the aquifers that turn the areas of Syria and Jordan and Lebanon and even of Egypt into desertification, the destruction of agricultural land, all water deflected into the Zionist state.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Target Lebanon, the untold story.
Now, let me put this into its historic perspective. As the report documents, the quest for water for the Zionist state was rooted in 1890 Zionist plans to include the Jordan and Litani rivers in Palestine under Zionist control. And the Nile and the Euphrates were already marked for Greater Israel's use and control. The borders proposed by the Zionists after World War I began with a point on the Mediterranean north of the mouth of the Litani, east to include all the sources feeding the Jordan River, including Lebanon's Hasbani and Syria's Banias rivers, which would fall to Zionist control. The eastern shore of Lake Tiberias, all the Yarmouk River tributaries passed east of Daraa to Amman, and then south to the Gulf of Aqaba, the entire region, and all of its headwaters were to be either incorporated within a Zionist state or rendered subject to Israel's military control and to be deflected and diverted to service Israel. This is a matter of documented record. Jordan's leaders, even their pro-imperialist leaders, have been sounding the alarm bells about Israel's, quote, water appetite, because Jordan has particularly been victimized by Israel's, quote, aquatic expansionism, because Jordan now suffers from a severe shortage. Villages in Jordan have no water. They obtained water once in every 18 days. And, quote, the chronic shortage is due to Israel's use of 100% of the Jordan River. Compounding the gravity of Jordan's water shortage, Prime Minister Muda Bedran stated that Israel's successful campaign to sabotage World Bank funding for the Awata Dam project on the Yarmouk River south of the Jordan-Syrian border designated 250 million cubic meters of water annually that was suspended from access and use by the Jordanians and the Syrians.
It's of historical interest, Ralph, to note that the Zionist plans, the actual engineering plans, were developed by Walter C. Loudermilk, who had been one of the designers of the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, which was developed during the New Deal in the United States. The TVA plan included using the waters of the Jordan, the Yarmouk, the Banias, the Hasbani, the Don, and the Zarqa, which is a river in East Jordan. And it was a comprehensive plan to irrigate the Jordan Valley, much of the northern Galilee and northern Palestine, diverting the Litani in southern Lebanon to form an artificial lake in northern Palestine, whose waters could be pumped southward to irrigate the Negev desert. And then there was an early version of a Mediterranean Dead Sea Canal that was also included in his proposals. And again, the Zionists turned in 1946, the World Zionist Organization hired James P. B. Hayes, who was another engineer who worked on TVA, and he was asked to take Loudermilk's designs and create the practical design, which was again followed by the Zionists in their plans for seizing the water and the regions of the regional water basin of the Middle East and acquiring these for the Zionist state. This also, Ralph, there are marvelous articles that you found that concern the seizure of the Golan Heights, and it is always used as the basis for security.
Let's look at this because point one. As the report in Washington Middle East report clarifies, quote, Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights was designed to discount Syria as a factor in the, quote, big water picture. Speaking at a 1989 Jerusalem conference on water, Dr. Elisha Kali, an Israeli water consultant with the Israeli Water Agency, said, Syria should not be allowed to be party to any regional negotiations on water. Israel will not share water bodies with Syria. Now, what's interesting about that is that the Jordan River originates in the Golan Heights. The headwaters of the Yarmouk River originate in the Golan Heights. And Syria is confronted not only by Israeli designs on the Golan Heights, but with Israel's insistence, Turkey dammed the Euphrates River, which had far-reaching implications on all Syrian water resources. The water expert Leslie Schmieder wrote, Israel's water strategy is at the heart of its campaign to retain permanent control of the Golan, which enables Israel to preempt any Syrian or Arab effort to use the Upper Jordan or to have its waters reach Arab territory or to develop the Yarmouk, quote-unquote. Control of the Golan is the stepping stone to the Litani. Israeli water experts predict that their access to these water supplies will, in fact, divert all of these major river sources into Israel and render the countries in which they are present devoid of water resource. And that is the relevance of the article in the New York Times on May 11th, 1997, Maya, by Serge Schmemann. General's words shed a new light on the Golan. Quote, it is an article of faith among Israelis that the Golan Heights were seized in order to stop Syria from shelling Israeli settlements down below. But like many another of Israel's founding legends, the New York Times continues, this has come under question and from a most surprising quarter. Moshe Dayan, the celebrated commander, the defense minister in 1967, gave the order to conquer the Golan. General Dayan died in 1981, but in conversations with a young reporter 5 years earlier, he stated that he regretted storming the Golan Heights. Quote, there was no pressing reason to do so. The firefights with the Syrians were deliberately provoked by Israel. And it had nothing to do with security. And indeed, General Dayan did not mean these conversations to remain as an interview. The reporter, Rami Tal, kept his notes secret for 21 years until he was persuaded to make them public. And they were authenticated not only by historians, but by General Dayan's daughter, Yael Dayan, a member of parliament, and they were published in full in Yedio Aranot. Now, what's instructive about this is that Dayan told Mr. Tal in 1976, you don't strike at the enemy because you think he's a bastard, but because he threatens you. The Syrians were no threat to us. But he said they were sitting on the Golan Heights. He says, I know how 80% of the clashes started there, more than 80%. We would send tractors and armaments into the Golan, into demilitarized area. And we knew if we went far enough, the Syrians would shoot in defense. If they didn't shoot, why, we advanced further. Until in the end, the Syrians would have to respond. As soon as they did, we would use artillery and then the Air Force, and that's that. That's how it was. We stormed the Golan Heights. We obtained it. And then he says, when he was the northern commander, directly bypassing the chief of staff Yitzhak Rabin and Prime Minister Levi Eshkol, he went to war to capture the heights. And the purpose of capturing the heights had nothing to do with the putative rationale that was offered at the time. They targeted it for its water. They sought to obtain the area for their control, to gain control of the Yarmouk, gain control of the headwaters of the Litani, to deprive Syria and Jordan and Lebanon of access to their own water. They seized it, and they drove out 200,000 people through it. What do? The same old, same old. They destroy their villages, they slaughter them as they run away, and they emptied the Golan of 200,000 people.
Ralph, let's return now to The Hidden History of Zionism, The Strategy for Conquest, Chapter 12. In 1982, while advanced preparations were being completed for the invasion of Lebanon and the massacres of Palestinians in the camps around Beirut, Sidon, and Tyre, A remarkable document was published in Kivunim Directions, the Journal of the Department of Information of the World Zionist Organization. Its author, Odeh Dinan, was formally attached to the foreign ministry and reflects high-level thinking in the Israeli military and intelligence establishment. The article, translated by Israel Shahak, is a strategy for Israel in the 1980s, and it outlines the timetable, the current timetable, for Israel to become the imperial regional power, based upon the dissolution of the Arab states. Now, we should state clearly here that the Odeh Dinan plan is very similar to the plans outlined by U.S. military forces for the master plan.
Well, we will come to that,
because
Maya, I just want to make this comment. Everything that we published in the Hidden History of Zionism in documenting the Odeh Dinan plan and the strategy for the 1980s, which are the origins of the category of terror, which is the genesis of the whole so-called neocon plan of World War IV and the dismemberment of each Arab country, Middle Eastern country in its turn, every bit of that has been now verified in a recent publication. We're going to quote that shortly in the Army Times, which specifies the remapping of the entire Middle East region. They provide the maps. Each country is to be fragmented and broken up and reconfigured on the basis of U.S. imperial control.
So let's return to strategy for Israel in the 1980s. And remember, just as the Zionist plans of 1918, 1919 earlier, just as these plans outline the plans for greater Israel, the importance of water, the importance of putting forward the need for self-defense and setting up this, again, the category of terror, that the Zionists were being terrorized by the peoples of the Middle East. And this strategy, while it has a timetable, the Israelis persist. The Zionist forces persist. It may not go according to the timetable, but they are persistent. Just as now, despite what is supposed UN brokered ceasefire, they are still attacking in Lebanon. Yunan revives the idea that had been developed by the former labor minister, the foreign minister, Abba Ibn, that the Arab East is a, quote, mosaic of ethnic divergence. The form of rule, therefore, appropriate to the region, is the millet system that had been developed by the Ottoman Empire, wherein administrative rule was based upon local functionaries presiding over discrete ethnic communities.
All under the thumb of the imperial power. The Ottoman Empire at that time, the Zionist U.S. Empire in the present.
The Muslim Arab world, he writes, is built like a temporary house of cards, put together by foreigners, and he cites France and Britain in the 1920s, without the wishes and the desires of the inhabitants having been taken into account. It was arbitrarily divided into 19 states, all made of combinations of minorities and ethnic groups which are hostile to one another. And as you can see in Iraq, these are hostilities that are fomented by the Mossad and the CIA and at the behest of the imperial powers. And as we see in Iraq now, which leads to a civil war and the breakup of that nation state. Ralph?
Yes. Well, of course, as we've documented and demonstrated, we have to make clear that one of the precipitating factors in the invasion of Lebanon in 1958 was what? The July 14, 1958 overthrow of Nuri as-Sayyid and of the infant King Faisal by Abdul Karim Qasim, the leader of the Iraqi Revolution of 1958. And that's the percent we will deal with that, because Abdul Karim Qasim, who I had the opportunity to meet in 1962 in Baghdad, along with his foreign minister Hashim Jawad, when we were discussing with him the necessity to arm the population, because he could only anticipate that the Israelis and the Americans would come for him. And indeed, 6 weeks later, he was assassinated in the third attempt by Saddam Hussein, the CIA agent in Baghdad at that time. Abdul Karim Qasim had confined the oil companies to 0.1% of the territory of Iraq, legalized the nationalist and the communist parties, mobilized the population. He was, in fact, the leader of the Iraqi Revolution, which was supported by all the population, the Shia in the south, the Kurds in the north, the Turkmen in the north of Iraq, Sunni and Shia alike. This was a national movement. The Ba'ath was a national party, a secular party, a national party in the tradition of the Arab national anti-colonial struggle in Egypt, in Iraq, throughout the region.
And, Ralph, this is actually made clear by none other than the U.S. military. In an article, The Marines in Lebanon, 1958, that I discovered on the Internet, Jack Shulimson of the historical branch of the U.S. Marines has a 50-page document analyzing the Marines' operation in 1958. That is when Eisenhower sent the Marines into Lebanon, supposedly at the behest of the Maronite president, Camille Shamoun, to protect the Lebanese government. But in fact, they came in on July 15th, one day after the Iraqi Revolution. And this had been brewing for several months. And it was in reaction to the fact that Shamoun, who had been chosen by the parliament based upon a religious confessional basis that was in the Constitution, where the president was a Maronite and a Sunni Muslim was a premier, the prime minister, and a Shiite was the speaker of the parliament, that Shamoun had decided that 6 years wasn't enough and that he was going to have the Constitution change and to remain as the ruler of Lebanon. And this was objected to by the other groups within Lebanon, and there was nonviolent resistance. There were general strikes planned, and it was then that Shamoun and also the Jordanians, King Hussein, who was frightened of what was happening in Iraq and what was happening in Lebanon, they thought there would be the overthrow of the monarchy in Jordan. And that's where they approached the Americans to send in the Marines, preserve imperial power in the Middle East. Ralph.
I should mention, by the way, because we're going to deal with the specific question of the sending in of the Marines and the Eisenhower dispatch of Marines, which was entirely related to this, not only to maintain an imperial presence in Lebanon and to sustain Shamoun and the puppet regime there, but as an opening note in the answer to the Iraqi Revolution. This was a direct threat to the survival of the revolutionary government in Baghdad. And in fact, as I mentioned, in February 1963, I saw Abdulkarim Qasim in December 62. By February 1963, the CIA station chief had organized his assassination, and Saddam Hussein is the perpetrator on his third attempt, as has been documented well by both the CIA station chief and in Jack Anderson in his column, and even in the Zionist Judith Miller in her book on the description of how Abdulkarim Qasim was overthrown. Dr. Yuri Davis, who we know well, who is a Middle East expert, has documented the following. The link between Tel Aviv and Addis Ababa in Ethiopia has a very specific dimension. Since 1990, as Salim Nassar has documented in Abdawila International, Israel has supplied Ethiopia with technology and expertise to dam the Blue Nile, a major tributary to the Nile. Saeed Shahat documents that the Mengistu government was provided with funds and, in fact, was induced to undertake a process that would deflect 5.4 billion cubic meters of water. Egypt, of course, is the victim of this process because Egypt's population increases by 1 million people a year, and the government must reclaim at least twice as much land as the amount that is available in order merely to maintain its food production for the population. Without the water that the deflection of the Nile prevents, nothing but mass starvation will ensue. While the Zionists plan to usurp the water of the Nile, as they intend to do in the Euphrates, as they've done in Yarmouk, as they've done with respect to the Hasdani and the Litani, that is the name of the exercise. That's why the United Press International reported at the beginning of this onslaught, Israeli army eyes the Litani River. That's why Netanyahu declared that the buffer zone won't end, that it is only a partial answer because they have to occupy beyond that. That's the meaning of the Marines in Lebanon in 1958. And brothers and sisters, this is the meaning of the ongoing operations that continue with respect to Lebanon. This is the significance of the article in The Guardian by Dan Plesh on August 9th. United States forces prepare to destroy 10,000 targets in the Middle East in a few hours. Regardless of any impending ceasefire or the removal of Hezbollah or the Iranian nuclear position, regardless of any of this, U.S. forces stand ready to destroy 10,000 targets in a few hours. U.S. readiness for more war is one indicator that the present war will spread and intensify in the coming months. Unnoticed amidst coverage of this war, has been and Condoleezza Rice anticipating that, quote, when the Iranians get past the August 31st deadline, you're going to see some things start that make life pretty miserable, quote, unquote, that make life pretty miserable. U.S. Intelligence Chief John Negroponte told the United States Senate that the plans are in full operational force. And that's the significance of Seymour Hersh's article, Lebanon Watch, which documents that this entire operation was planned in conjunction with Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney, and indeed under the command of Marine General James Cartwright. U.S. Global Strike Planning, The Guardian states, will destroy over 10,000 targets in Iran in one mission with smart conventional weapons, while U.S. government documents obtained by Hans Christensen and analyzed by William Arkin in The Washington Post has described the development of a global strike capability which includes tactical nuclear weapons, quote, from The Guardian, awaiting his orders, George Bush has over 200 strategic bombers, B-52s, B-1s, B-2s, F-117As, U.S. Navy Tomahawk cruise missiles. A B-2 bomber will drop 80,500-pound bombs on separate targets in 22 seconds. 10,000 targets will be attacked simultaneously. This strike power is sufficient to destroy all major Iranian political, military, economic, and transport capabilities. Such a strike, The Guardian continues, will take shock and awe to a new level. We'll leave Iran with few conventional military capabilities to block the Straits of Hormuz, to provide conventional military support to insurgents. In fact, the latest generation of smart bombs now being delivered to the U.S. Air Force quadruples the number of weapons that all U.S. warplanes can carry. These forces are now, The Guardian continues, on high alert. That means that the U.S. will actually use them. In combination with an increasing crisis, high alert levels, staged terror attacks, we should heed Tony Blair. The article continues, when Michael Gapes, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, queried the Prime Minister of Great Britain's equivocation about a preemptive war on Iran, asking, does that mean we are just left with sanctions? Mr. Blair's response was, well, we'll take this one step at a time, and The Guardian spells out what that step is. That's what Newsweek means when it says in its current issue, now comes the next war. Yes. And by the way, in that article, it describes how 85% of the population in Lebanon support Hezbollah and 80% of the Christian population ardently supports Hezbollah. In fact, the announcement by the leader of Hezbollah that he would defend all of Lebanon was specifically a defense of the Christian areas and of the Sunni areas. This is not just a Shia population. What we are dealing with, brothers and sisters, was spelled out by Paola Manduca on August 7th, new and unknown deadly weapons used by Israeli forces, direct energy weapons, chemical and biological agents, a macabre experiment in future warfare. It is a genocide. It is imperialism. It is the plans of 100 years. Target Lebanon. Target the region, target the populations of the Middle East and the planet.
But what the Zionist forces and the U.S. have not fully absorbed is that the resistance of the population will be consistent, will be universal.
But Maya, let me just say this, that it will be. But the Armed Forces Journal in June 2006 by Ralph Peters, Blood Borders, How a Better Middle East Will Look, spells out what they have in mind. They want to realign every country in the region by mass devastation and resistance on the ground, a generalized popular uprising, the removal of these country-selling regimes, and a challenge to the imperial war machine within the metropolitan countries themselves is the task before us.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Target Lebanon, The Untold Story, was recorded August 22nd. It will be available on our internet site, www.takingaim.info. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's PACBELL.net. We look forward to hearing from you, and we'll be with you next week.
Tikin do bin yai, tatan.